What can the Germans teach us about raising kids?
I had stereotypes in my heads of Germans that they were very strict and exacting with their children. And when I went to a playground, I saw immediately that the exact opposite was true, that they were very hands-off.
That's Sarah Zaski. We talk with her about her book, Achtung Baby, An American Mom on the German Art of Raising Self-Reliant Children. Then, what's the impact of severe adverse childhood experiences on health across the lifetime?
The more ACEs you had, the worse your health. And, you know, we're not just talking about behavioral health, which I think is what a lot of us expect, but we're talking about for folks with four or more adverse childhood experiences, they had double the risk for heart disease, 2.5 times the risk for stroke, double the risk for cancer, and almost 4 times the risk for chronic lung disease.
That's Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris. We talk with her about her book, The Deepest Well, Healing the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Sometimes it seems like the American style of parenting is driven more by fear than anything else. We don't let kids go anywhere alone for fear something terrible will happen to them. We stress over whether they're reading early enough or racking up high enough test scores. We worry if they can outcompete every other kid to get into the best schools. Maybe if we just relaxed a little more, our kids would be happier, more self-reliant, and better able to get on with others. That's what my guest Sarah Zaski found when she and her family moved from Oregon to Berlin in Germany. Her daughter was just a toddler, and Zaski soon became pregnant with her second child. She was surprised to find that German parents give their kids a lot of freedom. Kids walk to school by themselves, ride the subway alone, cut food with sharp knives, and even play with fire. German parents didn't share Zaski's parental fears, and their children were thriving. Her engaging and informative book, Achtung Baby, shares the many parenting lessons Zaski learned from living in Germany and provides much food for thought for American parents today. Sarah Zaski, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you for having me on.
I just love this book, Achtung Baby, An American Mom on the German Art of Raising Self-Reliant Children. It also left me really jealous of German children because it just seems like they have so much more of a healthy way of raising children, one that I remember from my own childhood. I mean, I'm a baby boomer. So much of the freedom and independence that German children seem to have is something that was very familiar to me and even to my son, but not at all to my granddaughter. First of all, tell us, how did you find yourself in Germany and what your first reaction was to seeing how the Germans treat their children?
Well, we moved to Germany for my husband's job. He's a scientist. And my daughter was 2.5 at the time. And my son wasn't born yet. He was born in Germany. And I had thought, you know, I had stereotypes in my heads of Germans that they were very strict and exacting with their children. And when I went to a playground, I saw immediately that the exact opposite was true, that they were very hands-off. And a moment I often talk about is when I saw an older child dangling from a very high structure and, you know, the protective American mom in me came out and I'm yelling, Achtung, which means watch out. And nobody else is reacting like that. And the boy dropped down and ran away and that was that. So I immediately thought, wow, something here is very different.
This is, of course, very different from the pre-war and our notions of German parenting, which I think date from the pre-war. I mean, I remember this horrible book I was shown when I was a child of Struwwelpeter, you know, all the terrible things that will happen to a child if they misbehave in the slightest.
Yes, I've seen that one too.
You say that liberal German parenting actually owes a lot to the reaction to authoritarianism of the war and before. talk a little bit about that and some of the other reasons why German parenting has changed so much.
The generation that came up after World War II, you know, they're sort of baby boomer generation. So in the 1960s, they really rebelled against their parents' generation. Same as what was going on here, but of course they had a lot more to rebel against. And they rejected a lot of things that their parents did, including how they raised their children. So there was a big break there. They even had an anti-authoritarian movement, which took it a bit to an extreme. Some people opened up daycare centers that had no rules at all. And I think today that German parenting has become more moderate than that, but they are still very strongly reject any strict or controlling way of dealing with kids. And you'll find that German parents, well, first of all, corporal punishment has been made illegal. They don't spank their children. And their discipline style is much different. It's not so harsh, not even as harsh as, you know, I'm going to pull you out here and you're being punished. It's more that they talk to their kids and explain why they shouldn't do something rather than, you know, lay down strict rules and punishments.
And yet responsibility is an important part of bringing children up, bringing them up with a sense of responsibility. So how does independence and responsibility, how do the Germans manage to do both?
Well, what I saw was a lot of accountability. And kids are very motivated by having these privileges, like being able to walk to school on their own or go to a playground on their own. If a child does something that is out of line, like say maybe they went to their friend's house instead of coming straight home, then the parent can revoke that privilege for a time. Okay, well, you don't get to walk to school for a while until you have gained my trust again. So there's a sense of you get freedom, but it's a privilege. And if you abuse it, then we'll take it back and then we'll try again. And I think that's a great way to go because that's how they learn how to be independent and to be responsible with that independence.
You said that spanking is actually illegal. Contrast that to Americans. I was kind of shocked with some of the statistics that you talk about in the book about American rates of spanking.
Yeah, I'm very surprised at how accepted it is still in our society. I think about 2/3 of Americans believe it's okay to spank a child, and over half of American parents still do it. It's completely legal in all 50 states. In 19 states, the schools can spank your child without your consent. Whereas in Germany, it's not only illegal, but it's not practiced, judging from some of the polls. And really, corporal punishment is perhaps the most authoritarian thing you can do to a child because you're using your physical power to try to force a certain behavior. And there has been a lot of research to show that corporal punishment doesn't really work. It creates a lot of resentment in the child and can create cognitive problems and behavioral issues down the line.
And what kind of cognitive problems?
Well, you know, ability to think logically and clearly. It creates a lot of fear in children and in your personality. There have been some studies done that show that kids raised with corporal punishment are more apt to be criminal. They also have stronger views as far as how criminals should be treated, which is interesting. So they tend to be more authoritarian themselves. And that makes sense because if you're raised in an authoritarian manner, that's what you know and that's what feels safe to you. So that's what you're going to perpetuate.
Talk about the German concept of self-reliance or Selbstständigkeit.
Sure. This is a very strong value in German culture. And they start raising their children for Selbstständigkeit from a very early age. They talk about children, even babies, needing time to be alone. And that's the sense is that, you know, you can be in the room, but, you know, let your child play and explore on his or her own so that you're not always interfering with their exploration. And a lot of German parents will also put their child to sleep while they're still awake. So it's a chance, again, for the child to be alone and to learn how to soothe themselves. And this carries on through the values of, you know, letting them learn to navigate their world by walking to school and buying things in stores. And the sense that children get a chance to feel capable as they get older and get more and more chance to be independent and self-reliant.
You had to deal with some of this in terms of, you know, falling asleep as infants. Your son, as you said, was born in Germany. Ozzy. You had a terrific time putting him to sleep.
Yes, I didn't sleep very well for 2 years. I was very convinced by the attachment parenting that is so popular here in the U.S. And I tried to do that with my daughter, but I was a working mom at that point, and so there was some distance there. But with Ozzy, I was home for a year, and you know, I answered his every need all the time. And while that might be good for when he's very small, when he got older, he became very dependent upon that, to the point where he could not go to sleep without me. And I was getting up 8-9 times a night to put him back to sleep. And my German pediatrician took one look at me one day and he said, "You need help." So I had a consultant work with me on how to set some more boundaries between me and him so that Ozzy could have a chance to go to sleep on his own.
And so how did that work out? How long did it take, and how did you do that?
It took months. The first step that she had me do was practice saying no to him in a good way during the day. And I'm like, I say no to him all the time. You know, don't touch this, or, you know, don't knock that over. But what she specified is that when I'd say no, is to not immediately comfort him, to let him cry and gather his feelings. And when he'd calm down, then I could go and hug him. And but yet the no still stood, that whatever I had said no about. So it was about being, she would say, it's acting clearly, which I think she meant, you know, acting very consistently, so that it's not a harsh thing, but it's still firm. And then I was to take that no to nighttime. So he would wake up and want to nurse back to sleep. And I had to start to tell him no at night. And that part took a long time. But eventually he did sleep through the night.
So you mentioned attachment parenting. For those of our listeners who don't know what that is, tell us what the American notion of attachment parenting is. And, you know, and the Germans don't completely poo-poo it, but they've adapted it.
That's true. Attachment parenting is kind of the popularized idea of a theory, of attachment theory, that this close bond that parents form with their children. The popularized version focuses very much on the mother's bond with the child. And they've taken it, I think, to an extreme where the mom has to constantly be in contact with the baby. So it's a lot of baby wearing. They advocate for extended nursing, letting the child choose when nursing stops. And at night, answering the child's immediate cries. It's being very responsive to the child. And supposedly all this activity creates this really strong bond between the parent and the child and gives the child a sense of security. Now, there's aspects of attachment parenting that I think are great. It's the extreme that I think is harmful, because as a parent, we have to balance that, you know, doing everything for your child and giving them some space to do things on their own. We can't be all one way or all the other, or the child will not have a chance to develop their own sense of self.
Yeah, you say that what we in America are doing to our children is actually dangerous.
Yes, because we're trying to do everything for them. It comes from a good place. I know, because I feel that too. We want to keep them safe and we want to ensure their success. But we ourselves as parents cannot do either of those things ultimately. The child has to learn to do them themselves. I mean, we all as adults have to learn to manage risk. And we have to chart our own path in success. I mean, even as an adult, everybody has a different idea of what success means. So if we're pushing a certain thing on our child, we're inhibiting their ability to choose their own life and to be free.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Sarah Zaski about her book, Achtung Baby, An American Mom on the German Art of Raising Self-Reliant Children. Describe for us a typical day. Let's start with your youngest child. Both of your children, they went through something called Kita, which is pre-kindergarten, actually. I guess we would call it preschool here. Give us an outline, basically, of the German childcare model that's been set up and that people can take advantage of.
Kita is a short word for daycare. Many Kitas, especially in Berlin, combine, you know, preschool, a younger daycare, like what they call Krippe, for the smallest children, with a daycare, preschool for the middle, and kindergarten, what they know as kindergarten. It's very typical in Germany for children ages 3 and up to be in some form of Kita or preschool. In fact, it's like over 90% of the kids are there. It's subsidized by the government in Berlin. It's free. And the other thing that's so very different than America is that it's all about play. The kids go in there and they play and then they play some more. And that's deliberate. They do not push academic skills at that age and don't think it's important. What they think is more important is that the kids learn social skills and self-control, leadership, creativity, all these things that they learn by playing with each other. And I was a skeptic at first, but now I feel very grateful that my kids had that experience.
Yeah, and when you talk about creativity, in when was it Kita or the kindergarten, there was an experiment to actually take away the toys, not as a punishment, but as a way to foster creativity. Talk about that and, you know, what ultimately happened to that idea.
It's called toy-free time. Not all Kitas in Germany do it, but some do. And typically it's a project where they take away all the finished toys from the school for 3 months. You know, so that means all the cars and the dolls, but they leave the furniture and the blankets and the regular things around, and the kids have to use their imaginations to use those materials. They need to rely on each other to play and, you know, outside things, which of course always lend themselves to toys, sticks and chestnuts and things like that. And I thought the idea was about creativity, and it certainly does foster it, but it's actually a project to help prevent addiction later in life. The idea is that kids sometimes use toys to cover over their emotions. Like if they get in a fight with another child, they can grab a toy and go play in the corner, right? But if you don't have that there, you have to face that conflict and you have to deal with frustration. And one point that I really admired about the German teachers is they willingly took on this project, which means for 3 months, the children are all going to be a little bit more difficult instead of easier. But they did it because they think it had a great benefit to the kids.
Another byproduct, let's say, or maybe even intentional byproduct of this, was to allow the kids to feel bored. And recently, there's been some research that boredom is very important to us, and that our creativity may be diminishing as adults as well, because we're always distracting ourselves from boredom.
Yeah, I had that idea said to me by one of the Kita teachers. Sometimes it's good for kids to be bored. And it was that same idea, is that they have to develop some inner resources and creativity and just being able to deal with the fact of being bored. You know, can't sit in the corner and be depressed because you're bored. The only solution is to, you know, get up and do something.
And these kids, you know, as you said, when they had the toy-free period, they could go outside more once it was in the spring. But the German idea is that kids should be outdoors every day in any kind of weather.
Yes, they have that saying that there's no bad weather, only unsuitable clothing. And it's true. My kids were bundled up at, you know, ages 2 and in rain pants and boots and sent out to muck in the mud. And I find that it's very true. And that used to be American wisdom, too, that kids need to be aired out, right? You just simply feel better if you've been outside at least once a day. If you're inside all day, it can be very, you know, it makes you sluggish and dull. And the idea of frische Luft, fresh air, is very important in Germany, as it is in many European countries. And you feel better when you're outside.
So how does the German method of raising kids, not just parenting, because you point out that the whole idea is many people raise children. So actually address that first. What is the German idea of raising children?
I think it's telling that in German, there is no word for parenting. The word is, they typically use it, Erziehung, which means sort of upbringing or training. And even some of the teachers are called Erzieher, instructors. So it it shows that they believe that the idea is not just the parents alone to raise the children, but there are teachers and there are family members and the whole society has some impact on the child. I think that's very true. And even in our culture, the word parenting did not really come about until after World War II. So it's not a hard and fast truth that raising kids belongs solely to the parents.
You know, there's a lot of emphasis. We've seen a lot of books coming out about developing character, you know, among American children, that the idea of grit. Do you think that Americans are going about this the right way, or you know, can we develop grit with the kinds of over-parenting that we do?
I think essential to developing any sense of grit is letting a child do some things on their own. If they're constantly being pushed by a parent, it takes away from their sense of accomplishment. An example or story that I love to tell is how my daughter overcame her fear of the dragon play structure in our neighborhood. It was very tall and very scary, and she was 3 when we arrived, and she was terrified of it. And for the longest time, she would just go up the back of it and down and up and down. And a couple of years later, I hear, you know, mama, 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 and I don't know where she is. And finally I look up and she's sitting in the dragon's teeth. And then she comes down the slide. And that moment, she is so proud of what she's accomplished. And if it had been me who said, you know, you should go do this, it would have taken away from that. And it was very important for her, even at age 5, to say, look, I faced my fear and I accomplished this thing. And that's a huge sense of capability, of being afraid of something and doing it anyway.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Sarah Zaski about the German approach to parenting. It emphasizes self-reliance and independence rather than intrusiveness and overprotectiveness. Zaski's book is Achtung Baby. So we've talked a lot about, I guess, the independence side of this. What about discipline? What are the different ways in which the German attitude toward Erziehung, or, you know, raising kids, fosters discipline among them? And the rules, how do they develop the rules?
In Kita, our particular Kita, they did not have very many rules that were not made by the kids themselves. They even had like a little session where they brought all the kids together and said, what should be the rule for our classroom? And the kids would offer things. They kind of know what they're not supposed to do. And, you know, the big one is no hitting. And they would ask them, well, why don't you hit? Because it hurts. Or even the more important thing for them is because the other kids won't want to play with you again. And the idea at the Kita was that the kids themselves teach each other what's appropriate behavior, because they give them an immediate consequence, which is, I'm not going to play with you if you're, you know, hitting me or being mean to me. It wasn't a method I always agreed with. It's a little hard to see Lord of the Flies play itself out before you. But in the end, for both my children, it made them much more able to get along with people and different types of kids as well.
They also have mixed age groups in preschool and even in the lower grades in elementary school. Is that right?
Yes, they did. And that had a really nice effect. In Kita, they often gave additional responsibilities to the older kids. One action I really liked is they would have an older kid be in charge of a younger one in getting them ready to go outside. So that was fun for both kids, because the younger kid is not fighting against an adult. They're fighting against another kid that they like, or not fighting against, they're interacting with them, and it's less of a struggle. And the older kid has the pride of saying, you know, I can get myself ready, and I can help you get ready. So the whole process is brilliant for the teachers, because all the kids are helping each other get ready to go outside.
Another contrast is with the whole idea, I mean, of course, we've had huge controversies in this country over high-stakes testing, mm-hmm. Common Core, for example, as well, and homework. So maybe I'm loading too many things in the same question, but talk Talk about how the Germans approach the kinds of standards, the development of standards that in the U.S. the Common Core is supposed to address.
We've pushed Common Core down into the lowest grades, which I think is ultimately a mistake. And the German example kind of proves that, because they do not have a lot of intense activity in, well, first of all, kindergarten's all play, but even first grade, second grade, there's a lot of play. The day is traditionally very short still, the academic day. It's a half day, so they're done by 12 or 1 o'clock. And even within that period, they have several times a day where they just go outside and play for long periods of time. And all that loose period of elementary school doesn't seem to affect their academics later on. And I know it gets harder after fourth grade, but by the time German teenagers are 15, they're doing much better on international tests than Americans are. So it kind of says, why are we pushing all this academics so early if it doesn't work?
Yeah, I mean, Americans are shockingly low. You know, 27th down in math. The Germans are probably within, what, the top five?
They're higher. They're not the highest. They're not as high as Finland, but they're up there.
So that's a vast difference.
Yes, it is. And I actually think that this period of play and ability to engage their own curiosity, because they do a lot of projects at the young ages, is actually a very good foundation for the harder work later. And plus, they've had a chance to enjoy their childhood. And when they get older, there's a sense that, okay, I'm ready to take on the next stage.
So why is it such a good foundation for academic success later on?
Well, when you have a chance to engage your own curiosity and to do what you want, you develop your own ability to hold attention and self-control. And these are the kind of skills that is often studied by behaviorists that lead to future success. So it's not just repeating back facts. That's not going to help you maintain a high standard of academic search later on.
And they don't have a whole lot of homework.
Not in our school, we did not. They had an after-school program called Hort, and most of the kids did their homework in Hort before they came home, if they had homework. We didn't have any homework first grade. There was a very small amount second, and third, it started to become a little bit stronger. But I never saw any of the homework at home, which was fine, because by the time it's the end of the day, you want to spend time with your kids and they want to be home. And that made home time much, much calmer and more lovely.
Exactly. But another part of the curriculum actually is traffic and mobility education. What is that and why do they have it?
Well, they teach the kids how to move through the neighborhood. This happened at the near the end of first grade for my daughter, and the teacher took the kids all out through the neighborhood and showed them the crosswalks and how the traffic moved. And after that, I was expected as a parent to start letting my child try to walk by herself to school.
That's very much at the heart of the contrast between what happens here and what happens there. I mean, for example, my granddaughter until recently lived in Brooklyn, right across the street from a park. So all she'd have to do is cross the street. And her mother, who's Japanese, never saw any problem with letting her go to the park by herself until her next door neighbor said, you know, I'm going to call the police on you if I see you doing that again.
That's terrible.
And my granddaughter, by the way, this was when she was 12.
Yeah. Well, at least you can say to that neighbor, it's not against the law for a 12-year-old to go to a park.
Because so many parents have been arrested in this country if they leave their children unattended for a moment.
This is true. We have lost a certain sense of community. In Germany, it's more the sense that the community will look out for your kid instead of call the police on you. And that the community shares the value that it's a good idea for kids to do things on their own. And again, this is something that we used to have in this country when I was growing up as well. And for some reason, that has changed. We have a sense of stronger danger, even though the danger is actually less. We have less crime now than we had in the 70s and 80s. But our perception of it is very different. And I think we need to talk more about this. openly in the media and privately with our neighbors and with our other parents and family members, because if that neighbor was instead, if she's worried about that child, if instead she was like, oh, well, I'm just going to keep an eye on her for a little bit, that would be more, way more helpful than calling the police.
It seems ironic and counterintuitive, but in many ways, after reading your book, Sarah Zaski, Achtung Baby, I had the sense that at the same time that Americans enshrine their children's needs in the first place, they're actually really ignoring their needs. At the same time that we privilege children, we deny them their rights.
Yes, it is kind of ironic. It's, again, the best of intentions that go awry. Children are growing into be their own free people, or that's what we would like them to be. But in order to do that, we actually have to give them some freedom and some responsibility. They have to be able to try it out before they are 18, or they're not going to really know what to do at 18. And I think we've seen rising anxiety and depression among our young adults, partly because they don't feel capable and they're suddenly thrust out into the world and have had no practice making decisions for themselves or managing risk or dealing with difficult situations. So I think we need to really look at that for the sake of our kids.
So what can we do in this country, both in our own families and also in our society, to change things so that we can raise our children in a way that creates more self-reliance?
Well, we can start giving them bits of freedom that we used to have as kids. And I think walking to school is a huge one. And I know it can be difficult, but if we treat it the way that Germans do, and we prepare our kids, go with them many times somewhere before you let them go on their own. And there's also the option of, you know, finding them a friend. It's always safer in numbers, but two kids walking to school or going to play at a playground always feels safer than one by themselves. And by doing that, by finding the friend, you're already making the connection with another parent who perhaps wants to do this but is nervous. And that's a small step, but it's a big one, because when people start to see kids at the playground by themselves, they think maybe they can do it. And there's also simply in your home, giving your kids responsibilities and tasks that they can do. A small kid can learn how to cut potatoes for dinner. An older kid can learn how to cook the whole dinner. And these are skills that they're going to need for life, and they're good trials because they have very natural consequences if you don't do the right thing. And it's something you can do at home without worrying about anybody calling the police on you.
Well, Sarah Zaski, your book is Achtung Baby, An American Mom on the German Art of Raising Self-Reliant Children. It's just been great to talk with you. Thanks so much for coming on to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. I really enjoy talking with you as well.
Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from Sarah Zaski's book, Achtung Baby, and hear another excerpt read by the author. Next up, toxic stress in childhood and the lifelong damage it can do. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We have an epidemic of childhood trauma in this country. Whether it's from abuse, neglect, parental substance abuse, bullying, or a host of other stressors, some 3/4 of the U.S. population has had at least one serious adverse childhood experience, or ACE, by the time they've reached adulthood. The more ACEs you have, the greater the impact on your health. Because childhood trauma isn't something you just get over as you grow up. My guest, pediatrician Nadine Burke-Harris, says that the repeated stress of abuse, neglect, and parents struggling with mental health or substance abuse has tangible effects on brain development. This unfolds across a lifetime to the point where those who've experienced high levels of trauma are at triple the risk for heart disease and cancer. Nadine Burke-Harris is the founder and CEO of Center for Youth Wellness in San Francisco. Her book is The Deepest Well, Healing the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity. She's also given a widely acclaimed TED Talk on how childhood toxic stress affects health across the lifetime. Nadine Burke-Harris. Nadine Burke-Harris, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this book is really about healing the long-term effects of childhood adversity. That's the subtitle of this book. First, as a way of telling us how you first got on this path of studying this, tell us about your patient, Diego, and about where you saw him.
So over 10 years ago, I started a pediatric clinic in Bayview Hunters Point, which is one of San Francisco's most underserved neighborhoods. And as I was seeing patients, I was noticing a bit of a disturbing trend, which was that many of my patients were being referred to me for ADHD or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And I had one patient in particular that really made me rethink the way that I was looking at some of the challenges my patients were having. So Diego was a 7-year-old boy who was referred to me for assessment of ADHD, and he was having lots of behavioral challenges in school. But when I examined him, I noticed that those weren't his only problems. He also had asthma. He also had eczema, you know, skin inflammation, and he also was little. He was 7 years old, but his height was average for a 4-year-old boy. And when I asked his mom about when his behavioral problems started, she became tearful, and I had to escort Diego to wait in the waiting room. And when I got the story from mom, what she told me was that his behavior problems started after he experienced a sexual assault when he was 4 years old. And when I looked at his growth charts and his growth records, what I found was that that sexual assault was also associated with growth arrest for him, where he had actually stopped growing. And for me, that really made me think about how I needed to better understand how stressful or traumatic experiences affect children's developing brains and bodies.
And you found this concept of the adverse childhood event with a checklist. Tell us about the ACE.
So as I was investigating all of the research, my colleague introduced me to this groundbreaking study. And I was shocked because I didn't learn about this in medical school or residency. But this was research that was done by the CDC and Kaiser, the health giant. And they asked more than 17,000 patients about their histories of 10 categories of adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs. And these include physical, emotional, or sexual abuse, physical or emotional neglect, or growing up in a household where a parent was mentally ill, substance dependent, incarcerated, where there was parental separation or divorce, or domestic violence. And for every yes a person answered, they would get a point on their ACE score. And what they found was that these adverse childhood experiences were incredibly common. 2/3 of the population had at least one, and 1 in 8 folks had 4 or more of these ACEs. But the second thing that they found that was really powerful was that the more ACEs you had, the worse your health. And, you know, we're not just talking about behavioral health, which I think is what a lot of us expect. But we're talking about, for folks with 4 or more adverse childhood experiences, they had double the risk for heart disease, 2.5 times the risk for stroke, double the risk for cancer, and almost 4 times the risk for chronic lung disease. And that was really, you know, this groundbreaking research that, you know, made this powerful link between what happens to us in childhood and our lifelong health.
And this study, by the way, I think a lot of people would think that it was a study of kids like the kids in your neighborhood who were largely from lower income families, but this was not the case.
Yeah, so in the study that was done, you know, at Kaiser San Diego, their population was actually 70% Caucasian, 70% college educated. They all had great health care as members of Kaiser. And, you know, since this original study was done, the CDC has collected this data now in 32 states and the District of Columbia. And what they're finding is that every single state that's reporting their data shows between 55% to two-thirds of the population with at least one ACE, and between 13 and 17% of the population with four or more ACEs. So this is all races, all socioeconomic groups, every geography in our nation, and it's really, you know, this profound public health issue.
And it's pretty shocking when it's linked to the kind of health outcomes that you talk about and draw the distinction. These are not linked to lifestyle choices per se, although, of course, lifestyle choices would have some bearing on this. So tease this out. What are the actual impacts on the body of this kind of toxic stress?
Yes, a lot of smart researchers have actually looked into this question because initially, you know, a lot of folks thought, well, of course, this makes a lot of sense. If you have adversity in childhood, you're more likely to have these lifestyle choices that are going to harm your health, right? You're more likely to drink and smoke and do other health-damaging behaviors. And it turns out that when they do the logistic regression, like when they do all of these scientific calculations, that health-damaging behaviors only account for about half of the risk. So that's great news. If you don't engage in any health-damaging behaviors, you can, you know, reduce your risk of these health problems. But it also means that if you don't engage in any health-damaging behaviors, part of the risk is still there. About half of the risk still exists. And we now understand in the two decades since this research was originally published, there's been a lot of work done to fill in the gaps. And what we understand is that ultimately it has to do with our stress response, our fight or flight response that was designed to save our lives from a mortal threat. And when we are exposed to high doses of adversity in childhood, what happens is that our brain activates the alarm and tells our body to release stress hormones, and they're responsible for doing all kinds of things, including increasing our heart rate and our blood pressure, but also releasing inflammation in our body. And when that happens too often in childhood, that can lead to changes in the way our stress response reacts, and it can have difficulty turning itself off. And this is what we now understand to be this biological response called toxic stress. And that is what leads to these long-term changes in brain structure and function, in the release and levels of hormones, in our immune system, and even in the way our DNA is read and transcribed.
Yeah, that last point is really fascinating. You say, you know, DNA has some impact, but it also has to do with epigenetics. So explain what epigenetics is just briefly and how toxic stress impacts that.
Yeah, so when we talk about the way our DNA is read and transcribed, what we know now is that, you know, back in the day, we thought, is it nature or is it nurture? And fortunately, a lot of really good science has been done to understand that it is inextricably both. Our environments actually affect the way that our DNA is read and transcribed. And the way that they do that is by changing our epigenetic regulation. So it's not changing our genetic code, right? That is our DNA. But on top of our DNA, and that's why it's called epigenetics, because epigenetics means above the genome, our experiences cause our bodies to put markers on our DNA. And these markers are almost like, you know, musical notations for sheet music. They tell our bodies whether we're supposed to, you know, with musical notations, you either play it strong or you play it quietly or you skip a section altogether, right? This is what these epigenetic notations do for our DNA. It tells our cells whether we make a lot of a protein or a little bit or none at all. And so this is, our experiences change the way that our bodies read and interpret our DNA.
I found your book really fascinating from not just the personal stories, which are great, but also how you explain the scientific level of what's going on, because you make it very clear to the lay reader like myself. So give us some examples of exactly how toxic stress impacts the brain or impacts the circulatory system or the immune system and how that can lead to specific diseases.
There are a couple of really important ways in which toxic stress affects our health. One of them is through chronic inflammation, right? Increasing the activation of our immune system, which leads to chronic inflammation, which leads to increased risk of things like autoimmune disease when the immune system attacks the body itself. We also see increased risk of diseases of inflammation like heart disease or arthritis or chronic lung disease. And so this is one really important way that an overactive stress response impacts our long-term health. But another way that it does that is, for example, when we're talking about epigenetic regulation and the changes to our DNA, one of the things that we have on our DNA are these telomeres. They're bumpers on the ends of our DNA that protect our DNA from wear and tear. And when they get worn out too quickly, then the cell gets old and it's not able to do its job anymore, and so it retires. And there are lots of things that wear out our telomeres more quickly, toxins, tobacco smoke. But childhood adversity is one of the things that leads to premature erosion of these telomeres. And when the cell stops doing its job, then that leads to things like diabetes, if that cell was supposed to be making insulin, or it cannot replicate normally, and that can lead to an increased risk of cancer. And so we're now beginning to understand much more directly how early adversity leads to increased risk of disease.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Nadine Burke Harris about her book, The Deepest Well, Healing the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity. And before I said ACE was adverse childhood events, it's adverse childhood experiences. Now, in your clinic, and you have a clinic called the Center for Youth Wellness in Bayview, California, you started using something called trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy with your kids. Tell us what that is.
Trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy is a mental health intervention that really focuses on trauma as the root cause. And it's an intervention that helps specifically kids or adults be able to recover from a history of trauma, right? To understand how those adversities have affected them, how they can reduce the reaction of their stress response to that particular trigger. And it really focuses on enhancing natural supports and overcoming triggers of adversity. And it's really one of the things that's really important, and one of the things that's exciting for me about this science, right, is that we now understand what the problem is for a lot of people, and we have the opportunity to address a health risk that we up until now simply haven't been addressing, which is the impact of early adversity on health over the life course. And what we've identified is that there are so many things that we can do once we understand how this actually works in our bodies. And one of the most important things that we can do is early detection, right? Even though this data was published 2 decades ago, right now, only 4% of pediatricians across the country are screening for adverse childhood experiences. And that needs to change, because all of the research shows us that when we do early detection and early intervention with things that have been demonstrated to work, like trauma-focused mental health interventions, we can actually improve outcomes.
And yet, when you're talking about, say, dysfunctional families, families where there is mental illness, where there's abuse and violence, emotional, if not physical and sexual abuse, you're talking about a family system that is dysfunctional. How do you deal with situations where, you know, the parents might be quite resistant to it? And also, how do you deal with it in a holistic way that, that really deals with the family system?
Yeah. You know, I get that question all the time. And so first, one of the most important things is that when I see a child who has experienced significant adversities, it's almost uniformly the case that if you look at their parents' history of childhood adversity, it's also really high. Childhood adversity tends to be handed down from generation to generation. And what this science allows us to do is that it gives us this opportunity to interrupt that intergenerational transmission. And one of the really important ways to do that is by recognizing, listen, I've met parents who have even abused their kids, right? But I've never met a parent who did not love their child. And one of the things that's really important is helping parents to understand, you know, because of what you've experienced, you may have an overactive stress response, and that may be impacting your parenting. So when something stressful happens at home, a parent with an overactive stress response may react in a way that is harmful to their child instead of healing. And one thing that we know is really important is to do, when we're working with kids, we have to do this two-generation work. We have to work with both the child and their caregiver to help understand, hey, how is this playing out biologically for the parent? And then how can we break the cycle by offering this parent tools on how they can respond differently when they themselves are faced with activation of their own stress response and situations that are stressful and overwhelming?
What you are talking about are very expensive interventions at a time when really mental health and all kinds of health are really under attack by those who want to slash government programs to help people, even if there are programs for people who are not just for poor people, but for the public across income classes. So I wonder if you could address that idea, one that's really coming to the fore these days because of the high profile of gun violence since the Parkland shooting.
Yeah, I'm going to say that when folks talk about how these interventions are expensive, my reaction is, you know what's expensive? Heart disease. Cancer is expensive. Chronic obstructive pulmonary disease is expensive. Alzheimer's is expensive. We are paying for that right now. In the U.S., we spend almost $3 trillion a year on healthcare, and two-thirds of that, 75% of that actually, is for the management of chronic disease. Having an ACE score of 4 or more doubles your risk of 7 out of 10 of the leading causes of death in the United States. And that's just in terms of health risks. Then you add on top of that mental health, violence, disability, all of these different things. And we are paying for it. And there's no more money coming into the equation. And so what we need to do is really think about how do we redeploy the limited resources that we have for prevention. Because it is true what they say, that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
So what about adolescents and adults who have had toxic stress as young kids? Is there anything that they can do to improve their chances of having a long and healthy life?
Sure, absolutely. So in the deepest well, one of the things that I talk about are the interventions where we have the best science that they help to counter the effects of toxic stress, right? By reducing stress hormones, reducing inflammation, and enhancing neuroplasticity. And those include good sleep hygiene, regular sleep, exercise, certain types of nutrition, mindfulness like meditation, mental health, and healthy relationships. And all of these things help to counteract the effects of toxic stress. And it's never too late to do these things. One of the things that we understand is that there are also, even in adolescence and adulthood, we know that when it comes to neuroplasticity, the ability of our brain cells to grow and shape in response to our environments, that most of that is in the first 6 years of life. But what I also point out in the deepest well is that there are other windows of neuroplasticity, including adolescence, when all those hormones that we experience enhance our ability to learn and our brains to wire in response to our experiences. And also pregnancy and childbirth is another time where we have a biological leg up. But it's never too late for anyone, because neuroplasticity, certain types of neuroplasticity, are lifelong. And that's one of the things that I talk about, is that it's never too late to start rewiring our responses to stress and adversity.
Well, that's certainly hopeful. And then just my last question is, what could be the role of a counter-influence in a child's life, and one that may not live with them, but someone like a caring teacher or a loving grandparent?
This is one of the things that's so exciting for me, is that all of the research shows that safe, stable, and nurturing relationships and environments are healing for kids. And when I say healing for kids, I don't mean that it just makes them feel better. I mean literally that there are studies, MRI studies, that show that kids who are in randomized controlled trials, randomized to high-quality nurturing caregiving, that we see changes in the brain structures on MRI. We actually see changes to DNA, the way our DNA is read and transcribed, some of these epigenetic regulation factors. And so this is what the science is also beginning to show us, is that when we do these interventions, when we do early detection, early intervention, when we provide kids with safe, stable, and nurturing relationships and environments, that there is a profound power to heal.
Well, this has just been a terrific conversation, and the book is one that I want to recommend very highly to our listeners. The Deepest Well, Healing the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity. Nadine Burke-Harris, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And if you're listening to this podcast, please rate us on iTunes or whichever podcast app you're using. It really helps to get the word out about this show. Thanks. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.